Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Mr. Harry Adlin.
Colonial ships and the colonial navies to me is a very important one. But unfortunately it seems to have been neglected a lot over the years, possibly because none of them were what you might call large, except the old service of course. Most were small, peculiar to this type of operation. Each state got to work and did something and did it in a different way to everybody else. The first ship actually built for colonial navy in Australia was built here in Sydney. It was a ketch called the Spitfire. Now she went down into the water in 1855, didn't last long because she was transferred over to another government department and ended up her days most of the time in Queensland as a pilot ship. The old Spitfire was the first. A sailing ship through and through, the 132-pounder smooth main arm. A direct result of the old Russian scares, which everybody else got a bit panicking about. Victoria kicked off in virtually the same year, but did it a little bit better. They realised that the British Navy, what there was in Australia, was in Sydney, so they had to do something a bit different than they bore the steam sloop, the Victoria. We'll see all these, with exception of Spitfire, of course, as we go along. The Navy at that time was virtually unofficial, as you might say. It wasn't until about 1861 when the Colonial Naval Defence Act started coming out that any actual official recognition was given them as such. Now, the difference between states is quite noticeable. We'll start in Queensland. Queensland always called their ships HMQS, Her Majesty's Queensland Ships. New South Wales didn't. But here we have Queensland with the two main units, Gayunda and Palermo. Now this photograph was taken after the turn of the century, because if you look at Palermo in the background, you'll notice that there's a 5-inch gun sticking through a hole on the starboard side, just above that little turtleback forecastle. She was armed completely different to Gayunda, which in that big port in the front usually takes an 8-inch gun. These two were rather, well, there was three we know of this particular class of ship, although the official records always regard them as the Alpha class gunboats. Harry Pepys and a few of the other old-timers always stated that they were built for service in South America. Quite possible because, you know, it's South American politics alike. They order something and then can't pay for it. This is possibly how they did come up. This pair here had quite a large span of life. Now here's Gayunda. This is a good shot of what the little ship was like. Now mind you, this thing is only 120 feet long. But that is a 6-inch, 4-ton breech loading gun on the back end. On the front end, she's got an 8-inch. Now just compare the size of it. We can see how far above the water it is, isn't it? It's not far from a submarine. But in fact, a pretty fair wallop for a small ship. My father used to tell me, I don't know if it was right or not, but he reckoned that the reason why they had the 6-inch was when they fired the 8-inch, the ship recoiled backwards, and you fired the 6-inch to put yourself back in firing position again. Well, it's quite possible, too, when you look at the size of the old girl. But there she is. Now, she came out from England under her own steam, sailed most of the way, but she made it. Only had a range of about 700 miles on coal, but that was neither here nor there. They made it. And here she is coming into the old dock up in Cockatoo Island. This was when she, in 1914, when she was coming in to be converted to a slightly different shape. That little forecastle the men are standing on was built up to the level of the upper deck. The 8-inch gun that she had in it was an old-timer, not very powerful, too big for the ship. So they decided then to modernise the old girl, so they built up the nice little facial on that so she was a bit dry. You can imagine, you can see the, from the water to the facial itself is only about 4 feet. And it wouldn't take much of a breaker to roll over that. So when you get another 7 feet of steel, well, it was a jolly good idea. But that gives you an idea of the little ship itself. 120 feet long and 25 feet wide. That's her in the dock from the other end. Now you can see they've whipped the gun off the back end. Probably giving it a bit of an overhaul, but she still carried it. But that is a good idea of what that class of ship, commonly known as the Alpha class, looked like. Small, tiny, but they could get around. Years after the Navy finished with it, she became a gravel barge up in Queensland, and there's that place that was put on during the war. Now what they've done there, of course, they've stripped the superstructure right out of it and used the old machining space as a hole. Not a very nice looking thing the way she was. She sunk up there at one stage again, but they pulled her out again, got her back into order, but she wasn't the same. She was getting on in years. So 1957 they pushed her ashore. Now when they rearmed that ship, they took the guns out of them, and in the old days there was absolutely no machinery available for returning them to store. So if a thing became obsolete, you had to get rid of it. So the easiest thing to do was dig a hole in the ground and bury it. We're finding guns buried all over Australia like this. But there's the 8-inch, which was under the parade ground at Kangaroo Point since 1901. They've dug her out. She's been refurbished. You can have a look at the breech screw there. The threads are still available, in reasonably good condition. The gun itself wasn't bad when they dug her out. One thing we've got to remember about the armoured on colonial ships, even though they were service calibres, most of them were not service guns. They approximated a gun which was used as a service weapon. Now that 8-inch was a 12-ton gun. It approximated the 8-inch Mark II, but it was not a service weapon. But the difference was, of course, they were built by Sir W.G. Armstrong Mitchell and Company, who ran the Elswick Ordnance Works. So they made their own weapons. So when you bought a ship, you bought the guns with it. This is as she stands today. She's been pushed ashore. She's rusted. The forecastle is collapsing. But when you have a look at it, you can still see the old fine lines about it. On the quarter deck, where the old 6-inch gun was, the teak is still there, and you can still pick out the actual holding down ring for the old Sutton Pivot Vavasor mounting was there. But as you can see, the ship is too far gone to do anything with. An historical group in Brisbane wanted to preserve it, but you couldn't. When you get a ship in that condition, there's not much hope of preserving it. The sea comes in one side and rushes out the other. That's taken standing on the quarterdeck. So you can see there wasn't much of a ship there. It's a pity, but he's like it. There's a stern view of it. When you have a look at the ship that size, you can see she wasn't really big. 360 ton. Sister ship Paloma. And here she is. This would be taken around the 1900 mark. She originally came out to Australia, rigged for surveying, and never mounted her main armament at all. In place of the gun down aft, there was a survey chart house erected, and the main 8-inch was never mounted. In this case, you can see a little 5-inch either side sticking out from the forward superstructure. Those guns, by the way, are still preserved. They're down at Flinders Naval Depot. The gun on the stern, of course, was an extra one. She blotted a copybook in 1893. She ran herself aground in the botanical gardens in Brisbane in a flood. Mind you, it was under command of an RN captain, so we're clear. Anyway, she went aground, and they were battling then to find out how to get the thing back into the water again. Mind you, she wasn't the only ship. There was another chap with her, a heavy flood. They were trying to think of what to do. Well, there you are. I mean, look at it. It's not a very nice place for a warship to be. But if you notice there in that photograph there, you can see the way the propeller shafts are stayed. Instead of an A-bracket coming from the bottom of the hull down, they go from the rudder post. One from the bottom, one from the top. It's an unusual method. We don't see it these days.
But there's a good idea of exactly how big the ship looked, because every part of it's out of the water. Anyway, another flood came along, and the Advance managed to get a hold of it, and they dragged her back. But a contract was about to be signed for dismantling the ship where she was. You can see the little chart house on the quarter deck there? Well, when she was converted back into a fighting ship again, she really got guns again. That time she didn't. Now, here's something that's very interesting. HMQS Mosquito, a second-class torpedo boat, 12 ton and 60 feet long. There was 8 of these built that we know of, 4 for colonies, 4 came to Australia and 4 went to New Zealand. They were designed as spar torpedo boats, and the spar torpedo was merely a 50 feet piece of wood with an explosive charge over it on the end of it, and you just pushed it out right in front of you, charge at the enemy, firmly implanted, pull the landing, and if you could get away, you got away. It wasn't a very good system. The only case I know of where an actual spar torpedo was used and did the sinking, the boat was lost anyway. They expected that. There she is, getting ready for a run up and down the bay. See the lovely little ram bow on it, very traditionally built. The rudder hung over the stern very much similar to Parramatta's. In other words, there wasn't much of a Parramatta in this when you come to think of it. But from the funnel, right back to where the group of men are standing, is all engine room. Now, there wasn't much in these things. They could get up to 17 knots. Very unstable. The spar torpedo was frowned upon, so they got corners dropping gear, in which you held a pair of torpedoes, one on either the side of the ship. Now, if you're only going to drop one torpedo, all spare hands stood on the centre line, and the moment the coxswain screamed out, drop, they ran to the disengaged side to right the ship, because all the weight of that torpedo dropping was enough to capsize the boat. Now, this was quite honest. It was a report from the Admiralty. The Admiralty said straight out, why the hell did you buy the things? Ha-ha, something nicer. Midge. HMQS Midge. Now, she was what was called a turnabout torpedo launch. Still did the same function as the torpedo boat, except that the way the ships were built aft, they had terrific manoeuvrability. The idea being, of course, if you want to dodge the enemy while you were firing at him, and he was firing at you. They put it up for carrying machine guns, but they never bothered of mounting them in peacetime. Ships were pretty wet, and the guns had rust up, stirred them off. But that is normally how you'd have seen it on operations. A lovely little boat. Quite fast too. You do about 16 knots when you wound her up. Now, of course, the mining in those days, submarine mining, moored mines and all that, was a part of the Army's responsibility. So each state regarded everything as floating colonial defences and grouped them all together. This is a typical Queensland mining steamer, the Miner. We had them in Sydney, we had them in Victoria, but all run by the engineers as they were at that time. The Brisbane River's changed a bit since then. Pumbara as she is today, 80 years later. Not bad, is it? However, it managed to stay afloat even now, as well. There's about 7 inches freeboard there from what I can see of it. Another one of the old exhibits. There she is from the stern view. Even though they've got a modern looking crane and everything else on it, you still see there's a little bit of old world class about the shape itself. So we hope that things like this are kept going and preserved. We've let too much go. This sort of thing would have to be kept. Now we come down to New South Wales, where we held the title of HMCS, Her Majesty's Colonial Ship. Now our New South Wales Navy was mainly a land-based navy. We built these two torpedo boats here in Sydney in 1879. Now even Navy Board told me once when I wrote to them that they'd built in England in 1885, which shows you how little we know about our own stuff when our own official records office don't know where they are built. But Roscoe, that was able to dig out the actual official reports on the newspapers, giving the full story back in the time when they did their official trials. They were built in the Haymarket in Sydney at the Atlas Engineering Works. quite a good works. It used to build low boats to railways, and they weren't always successful either, but these boats were. Now, if we have a look at that little torpedo boat there, there's not much of her out of the water. Lovely little counter stern, you can just see the rudder hose coming down, just forward of the ensign. Where the first chap you can see standing up on the casing in front of the funnel, that blur down below him is the coxswain. He was down in a little pit, and he aimed the ship at the enemy from that position. Quite an unenviable job, because he could hardly see over the torpedo anyway. The torpedoes you can see up on the casing. Now this one did the reverse. It was fitted up with dropping gear for torpedoes, and then at a later date they decided to convert it and its mate for spar torpedoes. Now why, nobody will ever know, because they didn't seem to do much work for them. But another strange thing comes with this pair. They are armed with a Whitehead torpedo, which was naturally the British one, and we also bought Schwarzkopf, the German torpedo. Whether somebody had friends in business or something that I don't know. Wolverine had been the flagship on the station for many years. She was worn out. She was going back to England to be scrapped. She was a little bit of smooth talking and everything else, and she was handed over to the New South Wales Navy as a training ship. It was cheaper to leave it out here than take it home. It would have cost money to take her back to England. So they just left the ship, and she fulfilled the job for about 10 years. Now, nearly all historians say that she never went to sea. Well, that photograph came out of the captain of the ship's own photograph album, and as you can see, there is no land in sight. That's one of the very few times, evidently, that old Wolverine did go to sea. But the sea, there's still a little bit of steam left. She's blowing off in the waste steam pipe, and she's got the sails up. The thing about this one is that all the photographs we've seen of her, she seemed to be in very good condition. She was well kept. Even though the hull was rotten, the sailors did, or the, you know, the volunteer sailors, tried to keep the ship in good order. And you can see there, she doesn't look too bad. Now here's a part of the mining force. The Miner, the old Neptune, you know. If you look over, you see a whaler pulling past the old Miner on the other side there. Funny part about it, on the quarter deck is a 7-pounder field gun. Now, we did things rather strange. We had to make good with what was ever there. There's a 7-pounder on the bow of the here in front of us. You can just see, the Miner rather in front of us, you can just see the two men standing by it. I have my doubts that these two 7-pounders we've got on, 9-pounders rather, we've got here on Garden Island, I think were ex-New South Wales Navy. We've got to locate 7 of them, and we know where one is, and these two here could possibly be old New South Wales Navy stuff, because on the barrels, it's chopped in there in big letters, strap-off charge, which is not a normal service method of taking anything out of service. The broad arrow is reversed. But one of those is possibly that little 9-pounder sticking up on the bow there, that lovely little steamer. That's the New South Wales mining force, as she was. The old Neptune, of course, was only, as usual, a harbour dredge, a hopper barge. Now to 64-pounder, and you've got a warship. Victoria. Her Majesty's colonial sloop, Victoria. There she is, in all her glory. She was the first Australian ship to go from Australia overseas on war service. She went up to help out in the Maori Wars and received some very good comments, both from the efficiency of the crew and the way they were armed. The crew of the Victoria were armed much better than the British regular soldiers were. Evidently they spent, put all their money in one basket and bought a good ship and everything else. Now, we decided then that Victoria needed something better. They bought the old white element, the old Cerberus. 1870 she was put into service, and here she's still down there in Black Rock in Victoria, much the same. Funnel's gone, of course, the two turrets are there. As she was originally built, as you can see, there was a flying deck, went the full length of the upper works. They covered right to the end of the turrets, and there were two stanchions neither end, as you can see there. to support it, which meant you had to be a little bit careful when you fired the foreign guns. But the idea was, of course, you were firing broadside. That ship could be flooded down. If you notice, the hatches on the upper deck have all got extended trunks. The idea was you could sink the ship by flooding till only just the breastwork and the turrets were above water. This was supposed to be an idea to protect you from plunging fire and things like that. You notice on the stern of the ship, there's four gallows. She used to do mining exercises and everything else when they took her down the bay once a year. So in other words, she was a sort of a versatile ship. She was supposed to be able to do anything, and would have been a bit hard-pressed if it tried to do anything at all. Here's a view of it from the bow. In later time when she was paid off, this is the time she was being used as a mooring vessel for the submarine depot down in Geelong. Now this ship itself is unique in a lot of ways. It is the first British battleship that was built without masts. It was the first one that relied on steam solely for propulsion. When they decided to try and preserve this ship, they asked the Premier of Victoria, Mr. Hamer, for some money to do the job. And he said, well, I'm not a naval expert, so I'll have to ask a naval expert whether she's worthwhile preserving. So I asked Captain Dave Hamer, who was a gunnery officer, and he said, there's nothing spectacular about Cerberus. Pity he hadn't read Dr. Oscar Parks' book. Dr. Oscar Parks was very wrapped up in it. That's her going down to be scuttled. Blow a hole on the bottom, let her sit on the bottom and become a breakwater. The guns are still in the turrets, by the way. Somebody's ripped the roof off one of them, but the guns are still in it. The move to preserve this ship almost came off. 111 years old. Water's been flowing over everything all the time, and she's still there. They do maintain they could effectively get it up and put it back in a plated condition. But all the experts on the idea of what they were going to do, one man was going to fill it up with ping pong balls, another bloke was going to fill it up with airbags, and Williams, the marine surveyor, said the only way to do it, patch up the hulls and pump her out and she'll float. And probably Captain Hamer torpedoed that one, of course. That's an aerial view as she is now, and that berth practically is what you would see of the ship in action. It's only got a freeboard of 18 inches in fighting trim. Mind you, it was only built for harbour defence. She wasn't really meant to go outside the heads, although she did a couple of times. But when she came out on a delivery voyage in 1871, she's reported of rolling 45 degrees either way. Now, you can imagine a ship of 1'6" freeboard, 45 feet wide, rolling 45 degrees. She'd be a bit wet. At the same time as they were putting the order in for Cerberus, they asked the British government for the hire or loan or presentation or anything to get a training ship. They got HMS Nelson. So naturally she became HMBS Nelson by this time. They decided to adopt the full naval title. This ship, when it went into the water, had been the largest warship ever built. Built for the Napoleonic Wars, of course, and however before she was ready, so she lived a very leisurely life. She was never commissioned. A three-decker carrying 120 guns. From the time of the Crimean War, they decided, well, we need ships. So they chopped one deck off it, put an auxiliary steam engine in it, and she became then a steam corvette, auxiliary steam corvette, as a two-decker. And now that's the way she came to Australia. A very stately-looking old ship. Old by the time, yes, she'd been in the war since 1814. But it fulfilled the job as a training ship. The big gun decks were full up of old muscle loaders, a few breech loaders. The reserves could get in there and play around. Every year they used to go down the bay, and the official flag for Victoria was first worn from that particular ship itself. It was a big day in Melbourne when they did it. The old service got underway, she got underway and they went around and pulled the flag up, not a good time. Then she suffered another job. They chopped it down to a single decker. Now you can see they chopped the sailing rig right out of it, just left it with one military mast, as you might say. This photograph was taken around 1900 here in Sydney. She was sold, brought to Sydney, to be converted into a barge. After she came up in that condition, and ended up like that, and worked in Tasmania for many, many years the same way. But during its time in Sydney, it was discovered the figurehead was still on it. They hadn't taken it from the soldier. So it was purchased and presented to the Naval Brigade here in New South Wales. And for many years it was over Rushcutters Bay. For some unknown reason, it's been taken away from Sydney and sent to Victoria. Why, when the thing was bought and presented to the Navy in New South Wales, is beyond me, but it did. The third of the Alpha gunboats, Albert. This is the Victorian Navy's unit, or one of their, this is their second gunboat. They bought two at the same time. This was the smaller one, same as the Queensland Jones. And she held a very unique position because she was good, new, didn't see much service. When Victoria was going broke in 1895, they tried to sell it. They even tried to sell the King of Siam, which fell through. Eventually passed out of naval service, and here she is down around on the Yarra Bank getting ready to be stripped down to another job, which she was going to do and did. That was handle explosives around Port Phillip Heads, clearing channels. Now, a funny thing happened with her. The Queensland Navy's gunboat, Paluma, was also down there, and it was owned by the Navy. So in 1916, when Flinders Naval Depot was starting to become a reality, they decided they needed a tug. So they said, well, the Albert's in better condition than the Paluma. We'll sell the Albert, we'll sell the Paluma to the Victorian government, we'll buy the Albert and make a tug out of it. So they did that. They brought Albert up to Sydney, took her up to Cockatoo, and Cockatoo took one look and said it wouldn't be worthwhile. So they sailed it here in Sydney. And then in 1917 she completely disappeared. We cannot find what happened after that. After everybody, nobody knows. But the other one, Paluma, which was the not-so-good ship, they turned her over to Victoria, and as the rip ran through till 1940, still blasting away in the Port Phillip Heads. The other unit of the Victorian Navy at that time was Victoria No. 2. Now this was a rather odd one-off type of ship. She mounted a 10-inch gun in a little forecastle, and there was a well deck back until you got to the control situation. Slightly larger than the other two, but whether it was any good or not, nobody ever knows, because these things never got a chance to prove themselves. In 1895, when Victoria's going broke, she went over to Western Australia. The Western Australian government bought it for survey work. The next thing we know, in 1902, she's back in Sydney as a tape. And it ran for quite a long time, too, the old Victoria. But that's a maker's picture of it over in the UK during its trials. All these gunboats, by the way, were built by Sir W. G. Armstrong Mitchell. But you've got to have something better. You've got to have torpedo boats. Here we have the first class torpedo boat, the Childers. The first Australian ship to be detached for war service before it got to its delivery point. The Saddam War was on the way out to Victoria, Albert and Childers were all under convoy. She was sent out of Sir Aiken. By the time she got there was no need for so they sent her on her way, but at least she was sent on its war duties on her way out. She's rigged there for sailing. After all, she only carried about 20 tonne of coal, so she wouldn't get very far. So sail was the main thing. She was towed most of the way. The tow line kept snapping. Eventually the skipper of the Al Children, Lieutenant Jerram, who ended up as a Rear Admiral at Jutland, said, bugger this, I'll go to myself. Cast off the tow. And he wouldn't have anything to do with them after, and he got it out here anyway. Our Childers lasted for quite a while. Doesn't she look beautiful? Yeah. Sea breaking over the bow. This, to me, is a classic photograph, this one. That's exactly how torpedo boats work in any sort of a swell. She lasted right up till 1916 as an examination vessel down in Port Phillip. But she looks nice then. But that's exactly the way the ships look, two skinny funnels. The boilers in these ships, by the way, were old locomotive boilers. The method of raising steam in a hurry, in those days they found that our locomotive boiler was possibly the best of the lot, until they got a water tube boiler, and the locomotive boiler was the answer. And to cut the size of the back end of the gun, they had a chimney on either side. Two of them together, Childers and Countess of Hopeton. Countess of Hopeton, the one in the background, was a bigger boat altogether. It was 130 feet long as against 112 on the other one. But they were quite effective ships for their size. See the smoke coming up out of the old black coal smoke. Evidently this was one of their Easter manoeuvres when they used to get the boats together and drift down to Queenscliff in Victoria. On the way back they'd raid Geelong and everybody would be up to watch them and they'd back up for another year and wait again. But they were the two mainstays of the Victorian Navy. They also had some of these second class boats. This one here is Lonsdale. You can see there just how small the boat is by the size of the man standing near the quarterdeck there. He is talking to the coxswain who is inside a conning tower. As soon as the gun gets up, he just jumps in, pulls a little lid over on top of him and sights the boat through a little sighting port. But from where he's standing, to just part of the funnel is all machinery. You couldn't live in these boats, they were everyday running, whereas the New South Wales boats, which were built before, had accommodation in them. They were a bit more modern than they built in the UK. Second class torpedo boats, they had two, Lonsdale and Nepean. And here's the old Lonsdale again, after she'd been phased out of service. And have a look there, the bracket for the shaft is lying dead on the keel line. In other words, it's deep. A rather odd sort of a method of construction where you use the shaft tunnel as the keel. You can see by the size of it there, there's not much in the old boat at all. They tried to sell these things time and time again and nobody wanted to buy them. Then they decided they were going to use them as gunnery targets and they were approved for that, but they weren't ever used for such an adventure. They both of them just pulled up on the banks of the Arrow and slowly stripped down. It must be horrible to see a ship get into that state though. Now Gordon was another one of these turnabout torpedo launches. She was a Victorian Navy job built in 1891, same time as the big Countess of Hopeton. And there you can see pretty closely what a torpedo boat carried for armour. The torpedoes there slung on their corners dropping gear ready to go. Four barrel Nordenfeldt machine gun on the bow, and there's another one down aft. She carried three altogether. Wooden construction, the ship, by the way. Gordon is one ship that always seems to be missed by historians. I don't know why, because she went into the Royal Australian Navy and lasted until the steam picket boat from service rammed the thing in 1914. But she's always seems to be missed. The name never seems to come up. Countess of Hopeton, on her delivery voyage, and this must have been one of the most lousy delivery voyages ever done. The captain that got the job of delivering it was a shrewdy. He took a group of merchant seamen aboard in England, said, I've got to take a torpedo boat to Melbourne, I want a crew. How far? So I was only a few days steaming. Made sure that every man that he took on was illiterate, couldn't write or read. Never went inside of land and got the thing out to Victoria. He was the only man the ship could navigate, so that would stick with him. When they got out here, he paid them the £5 for the voyage, he promised them, and then took out 28 tonne of hand-picked Welsh coal that he'd been using in ballast and sold it. He must have been a pretty good old skipper, is all I can say. They never took him in the Navy. And when she came out, she wasn't named, and they carried out her naming ceremony in the outer dock down there at Williamstown. A very unique method they use on it too. You can see there's quite a crowd there to see this because this was a big event in the colony of Victoria. They hung a bottle of champagne down over the stem, suspended from the bow door on the torpedo tube. Then at the given time when the old lady said, "I name this ship Countess of Hovland," bang, pressed the firing circuit for the torpedo. Launched the torpedo, you can just see it coming out the bow after she shattered the bottle. It's a very unique method of naming a ship and a very effective one, and I've never heard of it being done anywhere else but except in Victoria. The Countess lasted through for quite a long time, and she was in Flinders Naval Depot for a part of the time. She was down at Williamstown as attendant to the gunnery school there for quite a while, until 1924 when she was eventually sold for 299 pounds she went for. Now, Tasmania. This photograph is the only known photograph, or so we thought, of TB number one. This was another one of these second-class torpedo boats built for the colonial navies. Now, this one is the only one anybody ever seems to be able to publish. But, there she is again. Now, this one was found through a gentleman being a little bit observant. It was a photograph of a yacht in a yacht club in Hobart. And the photograph is of the yacht, not the little sailing boat there either. But in one corner, he picked out LTV number one. So what was an eighth of an inch long comes up there. You can see exactly what it is. You can see the conning tower and the funnel and the shape of it. The TB one, number one in Tasmania. Now, Tasmania did not have a naval force like every other state did. It was run by the army. Now, most historians say that in the late 1880s, it was sent over to South Australia, which could be nothing further from the truth. Actually, that ship came into the Commonwealth Naval Force, still in Tasmania, and in 1905, our protector towed it over to South Australia, because Creswell decided that the one ship navy down there needed some more ships to exercise with. So they battened her down and took her under tow, and she capsized on voyage. They got onto a follow-up way and righted the thing, and she was all right. And when they got over there, decided there wasn't much need for a boat of this type. Now, she lay for many years in the Harbour Master's Yard in Port Adelaide, and about 1912, since the last record we could find of TB number one, still going by the same old name of TB number one. It was going to work with this ship, Protector. This ship was officially a cruiser, and as a matter of fact, the Navy, this right up to 1914, still calls it a light cruiser. It wasn't as long as a Manly ferry, nor as high. 188 feet long, 30 feet beam. In other words, just nearly as wide as the Bathurst class 9-speakers. But on that hull, you carried one 8-inch gun there on the forecastle, and five 6-inch twin screw. Get along at 14 knots. And Creswell, who became the second captain of it, was very proud of this ship. The flagship on the Australian station at that time was HMS Nelson, which of course was known as the Imperial Nelson. And he said he was very proud to think that his little gunboat could outrange and outsteam the flagship of the Imperial Squadron. She went up to China, all the way up to the Boxer Rebellion. This was possibly at the time she was getting ready to go. A good clear look at the underwater construction, a nice round bow. Again, the same little turtle back post with the heavy 8-inch gun sticking out, 6-inch out on sponsons, and a nice canvas dodge around the upper deck, 3-pounder in each corner, machine guns all over, 5 Gatling guns. She was the one ship of the Navy, and she moved Red Cross's article on this recently. Now, French Admiral came here to reckon it was very good. One ship, one navy, you won't have any collisions and fleet exercises. Well, quite true. She was the only ship in the Navy. After the Royal Australian Navy finished with it, she became a barge, the Sydney. She doesn't look very much like her old self, they chopped it out. And strange to say, they built a forecastle on this one during the war, because they didn't want to go under. But in this case, to make a barge, they chopped the forecastle off. Brought her back to see what she originally looked like. Of course, they've taken that superstructure screen right out of it. I want to use the machinery space as hull, but you can see the round scuttles there that were down into the officer's quarters down aft. They were very roomy, very, very convenient, very nice. The quarter deck was just up about 3 feet. You can just see those nice little round scuttles there. Hang out the engineers and first lieutenant's cabin. And here is a model of the thing up in the War Memorial of Canberra, and to my mind this is one of the nicest models I've ever seen. Showing exactly the way the ship looked when she came out. You notice the hammocks are stayed and hammock nettings around the top. We used to do that in Nelson's day, and we did it right through until about 1908 when somebody realised it was a ridiculous idea. Didn't do anything at all, but that was supposed to stop shell splitters and things like that. The 8-inch guns ticking out through the forward screen, the 6-inch on the stern, 2 6-inch, one on either side inside the superstructure, and one on either side in the waist. Single funnel, very tall funnel. Matter of fact, she rolled it over the side on a few occasions. But she was quite a heavy little ship and quite a pretty good weight of broadside. And when her and the Wallaroo went up to the Box Rebellion together, now the Protector could fire a heavier broadside than the cruiser. Down on the beach at Semaphore is this. Now, I was down there just before Chris, before my brother died, and had a look at her again. She's well painted now. But she looks a bit scabby there. But the National Trust come along there, responsible for it, and they loaded up with paint. As a matter of fact, they got that much paint around the breech ring, it was impossible for me to find out the maker's name or the registered number of the gun. Now they're about a quarter of an inch deep, but it's full of paint. That's on the old Vavasseur central pivot mounting, which these things all had. You can see the heavy steel shield and elevation. She's up at full elevation here, 15 degrees. With the Vavasseur mounting, the recoil was taken by a slide, which split up the carriage there, as the gun recoiled backwards. You sent the recoiling gear with the trunnions onto the gun as well, up an inclined plane, which had, you can just see the piston rod on the other side there, a fixed piston, or a fixed cylinder rather, on the carriage, and the piston working side of it, slowed it up with recoil, and then by gravity she ran herself back down into its firing position. 1943, Sydney was taken north by the Americans, under tow, and a tow which had a couple of barges with it, and as quite often happens with tows and long tows, the tows overran the tow. It wasn't a collision as it's always put down, just a simple matter of often happened with tows. There was too much weight on the tows, on the barges, and they came forward. So to save all the consternation, they just chopped the tow line and run her aground. When she went aground, she was in pretty fair condition. But as you can see now, there's not much that could be done with that. One side doesn't look too bad, the other side is absolutely trash. So we've got one gunboat in Brisbane, and we've got another one up on the Barrier Reef. Strange, two of them in Queensland. There she is, as she stands today. She's propped up so she won't fall over. She will rust away. This was taken, I can't remember right, down on the slide. It's about 5 or 6 years ago since this picture was taken. So you can imagine the ravages of time will be possibly more evident today. But when she went aground, she was in good condition, and had it not been wartime, then she would have been pulled off again. Sandy ground wouldn't have caused any problems. Poor old Protector. And she was very well liked by the Australians. Some unknown reason had a bit of an affection for her. In the early part of the First World War, she was up in Rabaul as a parent ship for the submarines. She brought back the relics from the Emden. Whatever did that, she was used as a minesweeper. I might remember Ernie Boston telling us about his antics on her as a minesweeper. She was used as a store ship down there at Flinders. In the period of the Commonwealth Naval Force from 1901 till 1911, she was used as the East Coast training ship. She also became the gunnery tender for Flinders Naval Depot. Rearmed, rebuilt and everything else. She was reborn in 1911. Spent a lot of money on it, and it was quite a good ship for its size and age. But then, of course, when you come to think of it, when they paid off in 1924, we had a modern navy, and an old relic of this really didn't have any place. Protector's possibly the glamour ship of the old colonial navy,
was known by everybody, loved by everybody, and we've got bits and pieces of protector lying around all over the place. Outside HMAS encounter is the 8-inch gun. One of the 6 inches down the semaphore, they dragged two of them up out of the Fort River. But they were too far gone to do anything. Unfortunately, they scrapped them. I kept them myself. The only state that did not have a naval force as such was Western Australia. Well, I thought this was rather odd. I did a bit of investigation to find that Western Australia did have a navy. It consisted of 48 men and what was known as the Fremantle Naval Artillery Volunteers. They wore sailor suits and sailor's hats and sailor's ranks. And when they kicked off in the 1870s, they were given two old 6-pounder smooth bore field guns to drill with and no limpers, so they couldn't take them anywhere. Well, they went on for about 10 years under this condition. You have to be naval type to get into it. Because Western Australia didn't have many naval types anyway, so gradually they accepted anybody could keep the 48 men going. And then the commanding officer, Lieutenant Forsyth, somehow blotted his copybook. We haven't been able to find out what he did, but he was asked to resign his commission. Possibly took the 10 bob in the wardroom mess fund or something like that. They gave it over to another chap who then all straight away said, we better convert this into the army, so it became the Fremantle Garrison Artillery. The Navy in Western Australia disappeared. But we did have in all states, you might say, around 500 of the In 1901, when Federation came and became a fact, we all become the Commonwealth Naval Force, but for some strange reason, for about the first 5 years, they all operated as they operated for 30 years before that. They stayed in the United States, operated the same way. And then Parramatta came on the scene, of course, and everything changed. It became a proper Navy. The colonial ships were slowly, one by one, disbanded. Those that were useless were sold. Those were any good were kept for war service. Since the war was over, they got rid of them. Today we've got very little left. But we've still got the hulls of two or three of the ships. Service going under and protecting. Even though they're not much to look at least they are a living memory of our past. The colonial navies, in my opinion, were the start of the navies we know today. They've never been given enough credit. I think we ought to do something about all of them.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.